Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We make a point here with some regularity of noting that there is a war on the home front, not just elsewhere, that threatens this free world and most especially threatens its preeminent defender, namely the United States of America. A man who has served in the uniform of a Seattle police officer, now retired from the force and an author and freelance writer, is our first guest. His name is Steve Pomper. He has been a field training officer on the community police team. He's written, among other things, 5 books about depolicing America, which seems very much relevant to the topic we're interested in talking with him about today. Here on the eve of the end of National Police Week. Steve Pomper, it's good to have you with us. Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. I believe for the first time. Very good to have you with us.
Yes, it is. My honor to be here. It's an absolute pleasure.
Pleasure is really ours. And I want to thank you, first off, and through you, all of those who have served or are serving in law enforcement these days. It is a thankless task, I need not tell you. And I'm interested really in exploring with you how it is affecting those who serve in that thin blue line, as it's been called, that they're being so badly treated, not just by, you know, Antifa and Black Lives Matter revolutionaries, but by their own superiors, both in uniform and on the civilian side in so many police establishments across this country.
Yeah, you know, you're really fortunate these days as a law enforcement officer if you're working for a good sheriff or police chief, because then at least with the, even if you have the city council and the mayor that's on the other side of the issue and is anti-police, at least then you've got this buffer between you. You know, police chief James Craig out in Detroit is a good example of that. You also don't see the big disturbances in that city that you see in other cities where you'd likely expect it. But cops are so demoralized.
As they say, no accident, comrade, that you're not seeing those disturbances there.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, like, for instance, I'd still be working today if our department wasn't like it is. But of course, you know, Seattle, Portland, you know, just on the cutting edge of social justice warrior. And, you know, they've caused it so that police, the depolicing isn't where cops decide they don't want to go out and do proactive policing. They get to the point that they can't do it. They can't trust their agencies that if something happens out on the job that's controversial, that they're not going to be just, you know, fed to the wolves.
Yeah. Well, it's not just a suspicion that that might happen. It's being baked into the law in cities across this country now, it seems, where, among other things, they're losing the protection of limited immunity from some kind of, you know, civil suits if they're simply trying to do their duty and protect the public. And I want to get at a really important question, Stephen. I'm sure you've given it a lot of thought, but I'm of the view that what we're witnessing with all of this defund the police and, you know, attacks on the police themselves and burn down their precincts and all the rest of it is an effort to not so much eliminate the police as to fundamentally transform them, to turn them into just another institution of the sort of Marxist agenda and an instrument for its accomplishment. Are you seeing that in what's afoot in places, well, like your own city and Portland and others?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, several years before I retired, it was when the DOJ came in and, you know, basically, I call it inflicted a consent decree on our city. And that was basically quasi, you know, federalizing a local police department. And now they're introducing legislation to make that an overt action to federalize local police departments. And, you know, it makes sense on that side because we're one of the last conservative, institutions left in America. And they're going to need the police if they want to enforce their edicts, you know, their socialism. And so that's what they've been doing. I mean, you know, part of the reason I left was the forced indoctrination of Seattle police officers critical revenge theory. And we're just, that's absolutely playing havoc with police departments today.
Yeah, I don't know whether that was intentional or a Freudian slip. I think the term for it is critical race theory, but revenge seems to be what it's all about, isn't it? And here's the thing, as you look at it, I'm given to say, we're witnessing the demonization and the demoralization and the driving out of good police officers like yourself. I have no idea, you know, how you would vote or, you know, what your political philosophy is, but you're clearly a conscientious, public-spirited, veteran police officer. And to the extent that those quality people are finding it either impossible to serve or simply unappetizing to do so under these circumstances, we're going to find ourselves with people we probably won't want armed and operating nominally in the public interest, but not necessarily so. And again, voting with your feet is something that police officers are entitled to do, and I think are being encouraged to do by these forces. And do you have a sense of who's coming in? I mean, you've trained a lot of police officers, obviously, over the years. Are you worried about what comes next?
Yeah, it's definitely a decline in the type of candidate that's looking. And that doesn't mean we're not getting good people. But I know even before I left and back when I was an FTO, a field training officer, what they were looking for was more the out of their version of a community spirited type person who came in, you know, with their sort of mindset for policing, as opposed to what veteran officers would look for as what they knew was a good police officer, because they're going to back us, you know, so we know what we're looking for. But they, you know, they de-emphasize people with military training, which is a lot of times exactly what we want, because those people tend to be better candidates and better police officers. Not that someone who hasn't been in the military can, but it's just one of those things where you're just getting a type of candidate that reflects their warped version of what they think what a police officer should be. And it's tough when they get out to us, you know, in the field. And we see that they're not trained in the actual police stuff, but boy, they've sure gotten a lot of seminars and indoctrination on, you know, again, critical race theory and all that sort of garbage.
Diversity training, sensitivity, and all the rest, yes. And again, we're watching in some cities across the country right now some of the early returns on this strategy. And it seems as though, again, between those in the civilian side who are restricting what the police can do, even in their own self-defense, let alone protecting their communities, we're going to reap the whirlwind if we allow this to continue to metastasize. Steve Pumper, this is a subject to which I hope we can return with you very soon. I'm very appreciative of both your service and your expertise and your clarity on all of these points. How can people find out more about you and follow you?
Well, you can find me at the National Police Association, and that's at nationalpolice.org. And then my website is at stevepomper.com. And my most recent book is at Amazon right now. It's called The Obama Gang.
And Depolicing America is another important one. Thank you so much for your time today, sir. Come back to us again soon. Next up, we'll speak with former Assistant Secretary of State Robert Charles about, among other things, the state of our union. Right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, and it's an honor, as always, to be able to say we are joined by Robert Charles, former Assistant Secretary of State under the George W. Bush administration, among a number of other incarnations in which he served our country, both in the uniform of the United States Navy as an intelligence officer and in the White House under Presidents Reagan and George H.W. Bush. And he is these days a principal at the Charles Group. You can find his work most notably at a terrific organization, the Association of Mature American Citizens, AMAC. It's at at amac.us, where he is a spokesman. And we're always delighted to catch up with him. Bobby Charles, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Good to have you with us, sir.
Thank you, Frank. It's we live in difficult times.
Well, they're interesting, as the Chinese curse says, but they are difficult increasingly. You're absolutely right. Let me ask you about a topic that we just touched on with Steve Pumper, our previous guest, namely National Police Week in Biden's America. You've spent time in your last incarnation in the State Department with the law enforcement community, both here and abroad. How's it look to you, what we've done to our police and what may come of it?
Well, I think, Frank, that this week shines a bright light on those to whom we owe so much and have treated them so poorly. I mean, this is the Democratic Party and many of the local officials, state officials, and this White House seem to undervalue both what the federal law enforcement does in places like the border and in counter-narcotics, but also and counter-terrorism, but also the state and local police forces. And so, yeah, I think people have to realize rule of law is just a phrase. It doesn't mean anything unless you put it into action. And the individuals who get up every day and leave their families, their wives, their husbands, their children, and they go out to put themselves between us and all the forces that would tear America down are the law enforcement community. And I think people don't realize how much we owe them. Deterrence is everything. There are not enough police officers nationwide to turn and stop every crime. So you have to have deterrence, and that means you have to have public support for police, and that means that our leaders need to recognize the reality that if there are errant departments now and again, and they need to be addressed and corrected, truly we owe an unrepayable debt of gratitude to the law enforcement community in this country.
Well said, as always. Bobby, thank you for that point, especially the deterrence point, because it's often overlooked. And as we'll be talking about with Matt Kronig, it's overlooked on lots of different levels, but you can't afford to have the capability to stop every crime. You have to deter it. And that's where the confidence in the rule of law and the punishments that are exacted by the rule of law come in. Let me ask you, Bobby, about a letter that about 124 general officers, many of them quite distinguished, now retired, wrote about the state of our country. And the policies that they pointed to, I know, are ones that have been vexing you as they have me. The Biden-Harris administration's domestic agenda, notably this bill, H.R. 1, and what it would do to our elections, and the whole critical race theory indoctrination, and the open borders, and the printing of money, and on and on. These are the sorts of things that these distinguished military officers, not unlike their counterparts in France recently, have raised real warnings about in terms of the direction it's taking our country. You've given a lot of thought to these issues. Give us a sort of overview, if you would, of your thinking on the dangers we're facing at the moment from such policies.
Well, you know, Frank, there's a reason that those officers and everybody currently serving in the federal government at a certain level take an oath to defend the country against enemies, foreign and domestic. That's because our founders and everyone since has understood there are such things as enemies, foreign and domestic. And I think that one of the things that I find really disheartening doesn't begin to say it. I think that the current sequence, and I'll just touch on a couple of things, I think is extremely dangerous. This H.R. 1, S.1 bill, which they will now try to break apart, it got out of committee last week. It has 15 or 20 provisions in it that would essentially, each one unconstitutionally, undo the way that our federal election process works and the state election process. And what they would try to do is co-opt the entire thing, pull it up to the federal level, and unconstitutionally drive out these far left demands, things like no identification when you go to vote, all states having mandatory mail-in voting, et cetera, et cetera. So interestingly, this basically now, it got out of the House, it rests in the Senate, and it seems that Senator Manchin and that Senator Sinema will help to stop it, because it is. But here's their design and their plan. The idea is push a bill out, either in piecemeal or together, that would fundamentally change the electoral process in this country, that in unconstitutional ways, making it a one-party country. Essentially, the FEC would become one party. They would make D.C. a state, et cetera, et cetera. And then pack the Supreme Court with four Supreme Court justices that will somehow now rule these unconstitutional bills like that one constitutional. It's utterly and profoundly disturbing. So let's break there and go to national security. Let me just say, while that represents a domestic threat, I think that the attacks with some 18,000 rockets from Hamas now falling in on Israel in the last week and accelerating in recent days and hours, the idea that we could have a piece of our infrastructure, a pipeline, it's like an early heart attack warning on cyber attacks, state and non-state actors in this country that would shut down our gasoline flow. That's another major threat that again, is pointing in the direction of both incompetence and incoherence in our national and domestic security policies. The southern border still unaddressed, the attacks coming at us from China. Bottom line, Frank, is that my initial thinking is that we're facing an incoherent foreign policy and national security policy. But the more I think about it and the harder I think about it, the more you have to wonder as these Democrats now speak up against Israel and seem indifferent to the attacks from China, if there isn't at least a part of the radical left in the Democratic Party and perhaps even penetrating parts of this White House that seem not only not to care, but are actually consciously on the wrong side of history. So I'm deeply concerned. I think that every American needs to start paying attention now to a little more closely to national security and foreign policy, because what you're seeing is it affects our day-to-day lives, and it will affect our day-to-day lives more profoundly if we are not attentive and stopping and deterring some of these things and educating ourselves about what we demand of our leaders.
Yeah, well said, Bobby, and so much to chew on there. Let me come back momentarily, at least for the purposes of exploring with you a little bit more what you said about the Middle East. I'm really struck, and I talked about it in my commentary today, by the contrast between the Middle East 100 days or so ago, as Donald Trump left office, and what we're looking at now, and whether it's the pandemonium that has been unleashed in Israel, the rocket missile attacks, the riots, and now what can only be described as pogroms against the people of Israel, in their own homes in some cases, at the hands of Arabs who have Israeli citizenship, no less. What's going on with Iran, clearly emboldened by this administration and its policies, the Houthis, the terrorists more generally. Bobby, and not least, the fact that we've watched several of the states, notably the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia, which either made peace in the case of the UAE or Saudi Arabia, seem to be aligning themselves with Israel, are now finding themselves driven back into the old mode of having to stand with the Palestinians and against the Israelis. This is a train wreck of epic proportions and may well turn into a horrific war, it seems to me, too. Your thoughts?
Well, I'd like to believe we're not headed for a real all-out war again in the Middle East. But I will tell you, Frank, that what it points to me, points out to me, every fact that you just laid out drives home to me that we're witnessing a conscious lack of leadership in keeping the not only the accords that previously existed, but articulating reality so that people understand, again, that the United States is four square behind Israel and behind peace and against terrorists. I mean, one thing you didn't doubt when Donald Trump was the president, not only the peace accords and how they, but in a bilateral way, began weaving together a much broader peace in the Middle East. But you didn't doubt for a minute that we were behind Israel and that we would respond forcefully, which we did, to individual and to organized terrorists. And, the problem is that, again, as a diplomat once said to me, when you pull your fist out of the bucket, the water fills in pretty fast behind you. And that's the reality in the Middle East right now. Pandemonium, the word you just used, is very apt, because if you do not have an ordering principle, you will have disorder. And if you do not have people speaking up for the truth, you will allow the untruth to take wing. And that's where we are right now. And that's why the Biden administration needs to sit up straight, understand that this is not a game. This is not about domestic politics. This is about reality and keeping peace in the world.
Bobby, this challenge posed to us by the Biden-Harris administration is clearly being compounded, it seems to me, by our most mortal adversary, namely the Chinese Communist Party. And whether you think of it as an enemy without or through its so-called United Front Work Department and its intensive collaboration with groups like Antifa and Black Lives Matter and Liberation Road and Freedom Road Socialist Organization and the Chinese Progressive Association and on, the Thousand Talents Program, the Confucius Institutes, the politicians from Joe and Hunter Biden on down, Bill Burns, among others. These are the people that the ways in which it seems that enemy within problem is being made vastly more dangerous. And I appreciate so much your clarity on all of these issues. I'm sorry to say we are out of time for further discussion of that particular point at this moment, but I will ask you to come back next week and drill down on all of that with us if you would. In the meantime, thanks for what you do with the Association for Mature American Citizens, a terrific outfit, and through the Charles Group for our country, and your appearances here are really appreciated. Keep it up, my friend. Come back to us, as I say, next week if you would. Next up, we'll speak with Dr. Matthew Kronig about another kind of deterrence, the nuclear kind. What we're doing on that front, or not doing, as it happens, right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and I'm very pleased to say we are joined by a man I admire greatly, but from whom we've not heard in altogether too long. His name is Dr. Matthew Kronig. He is a professor in the Department of Government at my alma mater, the Edmund Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. He is the author of editor of seven books, including The Return of Great Power Rivalry, which seems to me to be an important leitmotif for this conversation. Dr. Kronig, it's good to have you back on Secure Freedom Radio. Welcome, sir.
Thank you, Frank. It's great to be back.
Let me ask you first and foremost about a public policy issue of, I believe, surpassing importance, and that gets almost no attention. Not from the media, not from the elite, and certainly, it seems, not from most of the United States government. Namely, the adequacy of our nuclear deterrent force. And specifically, Matt, I'm very concerned that there seems to be a serious effort underway at the moment to remove it from that force, what has been called one of the legs of the strategic triad. The land-based missile forces, which together with the bombers and the submarine launch missiles make up that triad. Are you hearing that too? And what are your thoughts on the advisability of going to a so-called dyad in an environment like the one we're in at the moment?
Yes. Well, the first thing I should say that I don't think people recognize enough is that U.S. nuclear weapons are special. You know, unlike other countries, we don't just use our nuclear weapons to protect ourselves. We essentially protect the entire free world. We extend nuclear deterrence to our allies in Europe and Asia. So over 30 formal treaty allies in Europe and Asia depend on nuclear weapons. U.S. nuclear weapons for their security. And I think the major reason why the world has been relatively peaceful over the past 75 years, no great power war, is because so much of the world is protected by America's nuclear deterrent. And so having a robust nuclear force is important. There's been a bipartisan consensus going back to the 1960s that the United States does need a triad. It does need the submarines, the bombers, and the land-based missiles. But you're right. The Biden administration has promised that they're going to reduce the role of nuclear weapons in U.S. strategy as a goal in and of itself. And so not clear how they're going to do that yet, but many in the arms control communities are saying one of the ways to do that is either to kill the land-based leg of the triad altogether, or it needs to be modernized. Others are just saying, well, let's just keep the old ones from the Cold War. Those are fine. And I think that would be a mistake. I think we need ICBMs and we need modernized ICBM.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, as I say, this gets so little attention. Given the stakes, it's just unbelievable. But the admiral who is now in charge of Strategic Command, Admiral Richardson, is really making it plain in as stark terms as he can in congressional testimony and elsewhere, I believe, that the Minuteman missiles are simply unsupportable at this point. They have to be replaced. They can't have their service life extended again. These are, I don't know how many years old now, but I think they go back, at least some of them, to the early 1960s. And the question really is, Matt, and you're a close student of these matters. We're looking at strategic forces threatening this country from both Russia and China that have undergone intensive and extensive modernization. And the question is, can ancient missiles on our side, even if you could modernize them, adequately deter the sorts of people that are now capable of not just brandishing, but possibly thinking they could actually get away with using such strategic nuclear forces against us?
The short answer is no. We need a modernized force. And let me just elaborate with 2 points. First, as you point out, the nuclear threat environment is becoming much more intense. Russia, China, North Korea all modernizing and expanding their nuclear forces. The U.S. Department of Defense predicts that China's nuclear arsenal could double, if not triple or quadruple, within the decade. Russia is relying more on nuclear weapons in its strategy, building new generations of so-called exotic nuclear weapons, nuclear-armed submarine drones, and other things that weren't even dreamed of during the Cold War. So the threat out there is real, and the United States needs to modernize, and there's a bipartisan consensus for that. So our nuclear weapons were, a lot of them were built in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, as you point out. I don't know if your listeners drive cars. If so, I'm guessing they weren't built in the 60s, 70s, or 80s. And if they were, they wouldn't work very well. So just like we need to update automobiles, we need to update the delivery vehicles for our nuclear forces. There's a bipartisan consensus for that. It was actually started under Obama, continued under Trump. And I hope that Biden continues that, although there are some real questions, as we mentioned before.
Another real question, Matt, which I know, again, you have been both a practitioner of in the Pentagon for a time, the Office of the Secretary of Defense, and the CIA Strategic Assessment Group as well. Arms control. You sort of touched on it in passing there with someone on the Hill and certainly in the Biden administration thinking that this is a better way to go in terms of trying to provide for our security. We've seen the Biden administration right out of the gate re-upping to a seriously defective agreement, it seems to me, the so-called New START Treaty. If the Russians have not violated it, they certainly are capable of doing so at any moment. But more to the point, in both that regard and its approach to Iran, the Biden-Harris administration seems to really be failing to learn anything from history. And that is that arms control with tyrannical regimes that don't keep their word are fundamentally fraudulent and leave us actually more vulnerable, not more secure. Your thoughts?
Yes, I think there are three schools of thought on arms control. I think at one extreme, and I think that many in the Biden administration might be in this school, that arms control is kind of a good in and of itself. It represents cooperation among adversaries. We're limiting dangerous weapons. It's desirable, kind of regardless of the details. I think at the other extreme, you have people.
Yes, that's the don't bother me with the details school, I think you might say.
And then at the other extreme, you have people who'd say, well, you know, we don't want to put any limits on ourselves. We can never trust other countries. I'd put myself somewhere in the middle. I'd say I'm a pragmatist. There can be arms control agreements that make sense, and it does depend on the details. Sometimes they make sense, sometimes they don't. And I think these are two agreements that did not make sense. So with the New START agreement, the major problem there is New START only limits a certain type of nuclear weapons, so-called strategic deployed nuclear weapons. And so what Russia is essentially doing is locking us in place in that category and then building up a bunch of other categories of nuclear weapons that aren't limited by the treaty that the United States doesn't possess. So they're building a lot of battlefield nuclear weapons, nuclear torpedoes, drones, depth charges, mines, surface-to-air missiles, and they're building these exotic nuclear weapons that I mentioned before, like submarine drones, that are also not covered. So essentially, by being locked in place in New START, we're ceding kind of nuclear superiority to Russia. They have a quantitative advantage over us now in New START. And the Iran nuclear...
Quantitative, but also the thing that I'm getting at, Matt, is... Quite apart from that, the qualitative advantage of having consistently and serially modernized their forces. It's not just that they've made this wholesale change out by some estimates of some 20 different nuclear systems, but that they have actually advanced the state of the art, probably by doing illegal underground testing, but whatever, they have... advance the state of the art. So in some cases, people say we may not even really know what kind of nuclear effects they can achieve with some of these weapons. Some of them are just horrific to contemplate. All of them would be, I guess, but some like this intercontinental range torpedo with a 100 megaton warhead. I mean, it's just unimaginable what damage that thing could do. But the point is, it's both that we've let our adversary steal a march on us, as you say, quantitatively as well as qualitatively. That worries me about the future of our deterrent posture if we don't get cracking here.
Yes, I agree. And as we debate modernization, there are no such debates in Moscow or Beijing. They're moving full speed ahead. Russia and China are finishing modernization cycles, fielding new capabilities while we're here still debating it. One of the major arguments is... critics in the United States say, well, it's too expensive. We should be spending this money on roads or hospitals, not on nuclear weapons. But I think former Secretary of Defense Mattis put it well when he said, we can afford national survival.
We can't afford to go without it, needless to say. And Matt, we don't have time to really do justice to the second point, which is the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. But in the shortest of short forms, you don't agree that getting back into it is a good idea. Is that right?
Yeah, the deal was flawed from the beginning. The United States has always tried to prevent the spread of enrichment capabilities to all countries, even our allies. And the Iran deal grants Iran a right to enrich, and that should have... been a red line for us, but we caved on that and we let Iran have nuclear capabilities that we don't even trust democratic allies like South Korea to possess. So returning to the episode.
Matt, we have to have you back for a much longer chat. It's been, as I say, altogether too long, and we look forward to a visit with you at greater length on these issues and so much more. Thank you for the work you have done for our country in the government and that you are now rendering, trying to inculcate in our next generation some sense about these vital national security priorities. I know you'll keep it up, and we'll look forward to talking with you again soon. Next up, we will speak with Saleh Hadayar about genocide among his Uyghur Muslim counterparts. That and more right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, and we're joined by a man that I have come to admire for his leadership in a very important cause. His name is Saleh Hadayar. He is the founder of East Turkestan Awakening and has been elected the Prime Minister of the East Turkestan Government in Exile. Now, East Turkestan may not be a term or a name you're familiar with, though we do talk about it with some regularity here. It's come to be known as Xinjiang, a region of Western China since the Chinese communists took over the place, but it has been in the past and should by right be in the future, an independent, sovereign, and free nation. Its predominant population is Uyghur Muslim, and they've been brutally mistreated by the Chinese Communist Party. Indeed, the United States government under both the Trump and Biden administrations has found what is going on there at the hands of the CCP to be genocide. We're very pleased to talk with the Prime Minister in exile, Sally Houdayar, about all of that. Welcome, Sally. Good to have you back, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Where to begin? Talk, if you would, Sally, a bit about the evidentiary basis for this finding, that what is happening to your countrymen is not just oppression, which is rife in China of all kinds of people, including the Chinese themselves, by the Chinese Communist Party, but is actually genocide, according to the definition in the Genocide Convention.
Yes, for decades, China has been colonizing East Turkestan. And in recent years, especially with Xi Jinping coming to the helm of power in 2013, and with the unveiling of the Belt and Road Initiative, which is a multi-trillion dollar mega project to ensure China becomes the world's largest, the world's most powerful military, political, and economic power, China began to focus more brutally on the East Turkestan issue because East Turkestan is strategically located as the cornerstone of the Belt and Road Initiative. And fearing the potential
Let's just interrupt for just 1 second on that point, Sally, though, because this is something that isn't, I think, adequately understood. China wishes to colonize the world. It is not content with the captive nations it currently has, one of which is East Turkestan, another is Tibet, another is Southern Mongolia. Now you could, I guess, add Hong Kong into that mix. They aspire to do the same to Taiwan, of course, but they're working assiduously now to extend their long and oppressive arm into Asia, and they have to get to it, overland at least, through East Turkestan. So this is very much part of the strategic purpose here, as well as, you know, the effort to control what has been from time to time, it's fair to say, a restive population, right?
Absolutely. And with that, fearing that East Turkestan might regain its independence, China under Xi Jinping decided that they're going to carry out a final solution to help achieve their so-called national rejuvenation. And so by 2014, you had the mass internment of hundreds of thousands of Uyghurs. And by 2016, which initially targeted males between the ages of 15 and 45 on the basis that they would be resistant against the Chinese state. Then by 2016, they began to target everyone of all walks of life, males, females, doctors, artists, professionals, lawyers, religious leaders, students, with the goal of so-called re-educating them in what the Chinese government describes as re-education camps, but what the U.S. Department of Defense and the U.S. government and the rest of the world have come to know as concentration camps. In these camps, China has been forcibly indoctrinating some of these people, whereas others are being tortured. Many are being actually killed for their organs, which are actually being sold to Muslim countries as halal organs. And then you have women that are being systematically raped by Chinese communist security forces. And on top of that, you have the Chinese government forcibly sterilizing hundreds of thousands of women. And in the past 2 years, they've set up a growth rate of our population to be at zero. And in fact, yesterday, new research came out on this, in which between 2017 and 2016, over 260,000 births, you know, were prevented from the natural growth rate.
This is a stunning and horrifying portrait of what is being done to your people, Sally. And I don't know that it's adequately understood by the rest of the world. There does seem to be a growing willingness on the part of at least some key governments to describe it as genocide. And that obliges at least the signatories of the Genocide Convention, which prohibits this kind of behavior, to take actions to stop the genocide and punish those responsible for it. Which brings me to an initiative that I'm very supportive of, and our Committee on the Present Danger China has, as you know, worked with, among others, Reggie Littlejohn at Women's Rights Without Frontiers and what we call the Captive Nations Coalition, of which East Turkestan is a part, to try to ensure that, at the very least, if we're not going to punish the Chinese for this, and we should, or we're not going to intervene in ways that would actually stop the genocide, which I believe we should as well. At the very least, we don't reward them for engaging this kind of behavior, engaging in this kind of behavior, let alone legitimate it. And that's what really worries me about proceeding to participate in the Olympic Games that are now scheduled for February of next year in Beijing. This is a transnational criminal organization, and there's lots of reasons not to want to sponsor these games or support them or otherwise participate in them. But the genocide of the Uyghur population seems to me to be a top priority here and making that argument. How do you feel about these genocide games, as they're being called, and not attending or otherwise supporting them? Sally, how do you?
We totally agree with the initiative that Reggie Littlejohn and the Captive Nations Coalition have undertaken. We shouldn't be rewarding China for China and its Communist Party for the genocide that it's undertaking in East Turkestan, or the oppression that it's undertaking in other captive nations. We've called on, you know, governments, you know, the International Olympic Committee, and athletes to boycott at least from the Beijing 22 Olympics, or to relocate it to a different country that is not engaged in such atrocities.
Freedom games, in other words, rather than genocide games. And Sally, let me just ask you also quickly. One of the things that I believe athletes, among others, need to be mindful of, and your people can attest to from hard experience, is the comprehensive surveillance and repression and, extraction involuntarily of personal information, genetic information, for example, that could be used in all kinds of horrifying ways, including bioengineering viruses or superhumans. These are the sorts of things that it would seem to me argue again for not participating in these games as athletes, let alone as nations.
Absolutely. I mean, Chinese, the PLA's biowarfare strategy clearly states that they are developing the capabilities to engage in ethnic-specific genetic attacks, which is essentially biological warfare.
And this is just part, again, of why this transnational criminal organization should be designated as such, punished as such, and not in any way legitimated, rewarded, or otherwise emboldened. Saleh Hudayar, thank you for what you do in our country on behalf of your countrymen and women and the rest of the world, I believe, in opposing the Chinese Communist Party. I hope you come back to us with updates on all of this in the near future. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.